Yeah, it's Friday, right? Hello! The one good thing about Friday is that tomorrow's Saturday, right? Hey, the killer George Zimmerman is back in jail. This happened a couple hours ago during a late afternoon hearing in Sanford, Florida. A county circuit judge ordered Zimmerman to surrender to authorities within 48 hours. The judge made his ruling shortly after an assistant state attorney asserted that Mr. Zimmerman and his wife, Shelley, lied during a bail hearing on April 20th, and they were, quote, very deceptive, end quote, about assets available to them. The hearing cleared the way for Zimmerman's release from jail on her $150,000 bond back in April. He had to put up 10% to make bail. The judge determined that Zimmerman, who has been in hiding because of concerns about his safety, had engaged in, quote, material falsehoods, end quote. And an issue is the roughly $200,000 Zimmerman raised through a bunch of right-wing sons of bitches in this. Oh, it doesn't say that. I just added that. Money that Zimmerman's lawyer, Mark O'Mara, said he learned of several days after the bond hearing. Well, I had no idea. In an interview, O'Mara said, was it a misrepresentation? Well, possibly. Possibly. It looks like they should have told the judge about the money, but they didn't take the funds and run. Oh, well then, lying is okay. If you don't lie and run, it's okay. No problem. And the attorney said they only used $5,000 towards the bond, and more significantly, when I found out about the money and suggested they turn it over to me to put it in trust, I did so immediately. As an officer of the court then, dumbass, why didn't you tell the judge? Yeah, well, nobody asked you, right? Ah. So, one more move to focus attention back on the credibility of the killer, George Zimmerman, and the lies he told regarding the night he murdered Trayvon Martin. Back in jail. Hope they put you in protective custody in there, pal. Sanford, Florida? Do you know how many Negroes you're going to run into in Sanford, Florida lockup? Huh? A lot. Do you remember, when was it? Last week? We were talking about Chris Hayes on MSNBC. He has a Saturday program called, what's it called? Up? Is it called Up? I should know. Anyway, Chris Hayes, it was on, it was on Memorial Day. Or the day before Memorial Day. And he was raising the same issues that I've raised many times and a lot of listeners to this program have raised about the issue of calling everybody who goes into the military a hero, you know, which is ridiculous on its face and insidious at its heart because it completely colors the real reason that corporate America uses our military. It's for nothing heroic. Now, acts of heroism can occur. I mean, a couple of people who are protecting each other's flank while they're in a fire zone or a combat zone. And acts of heroism can occur, one person saving another person's life. Of course, the bottom line is, if they weren't there to begin with, well, you understand. So, Chris Hayes offered a suggestion that, his words were very carefully measured. He offered the suggestion that maybe the term hero shouldn't be quite as, you know, tossed around as cavalierly as it is, that there was really meaning to the word. Words do have meanings. Someone who sits at a council in Alabama and in a military uniform and unleashes a Hellfire missile against six children and incinerates them is no hero. That's a goddamn killer. That's a murderer. That's a war criminal. And the fact that that crime was committed while this person was in uniform makes it even worse. So anyway, Chris Hayes made a statement, and the next day, after all sorts of criticism came from the right-wing trolls in this country. The very next day, Chris Hayes issued an apology, saying he was, quote, deeply sorry, and, quote, truly sorry. But, I mean, the words that caused the controversy, as Fair.org reports, seem to have no linkage to the apology. Chris Hayes pointed out that he, as a TV host, is removed from the real experience of the wars, as are most people. And he also said that asking questions about that fact was a key part of the point of the show. He goes on to say that this distance from the war makes it easy to, quote, not ask questions about the direction of our strategy in Afghanistan and to assuage our own collective guilt about this disconnect with a pro forma ritual that we observe briefly before returning to our barbecues, end quote. Now, it's hard to argue with that, but that doesn't really get at the comments that sparked the controversy. And he closed by writing this, quote, that in seeking to discuss the civilian-military divide and the social distance between those who fight and those who don't, I ended up reinforcing that divide, conforming to a stereotype of a removed pundit whose views are not anchored in the very real way and very wrenching experience of this long decade of war, end quote, Chris Hayes. Oh, my God. That's like confessions before, during the Soviet purges, during the Stalin purges. This is astonishing. Chris Hayes, go to fear.org and listen to what he really said. Ah, this is what we were talking about earlier this week, remember? This is why certain people never make it to mainstream television. And damn right. And why once certain people do, the hammer comes down. Just think of the people like Phil Donahue and Keith Olbermann and Cenk Uygur and who else? All these people who have been spanked for telling mild truths. There will be no mild truths where it concerns criticism of our national security state and its actions. There will be none. Or Mr. Obama and his heading up Murder, Inc., White House style. There will be no talk about this. I don't think MSNBC to this moment, nobody on that station, with the exception of a passing comment on Morning Joe, I don't think anyone on MSNBC has brought up the hit list story that was the front page of the New York Times. Why was it a front page? Because, why'd the Times report it? Because they did investigative reporting? No. The Obama administration invited them in. And why did he do that? Well, to prove to the American voter that he's no goddamn wimp. He's no wimp. I will sit here. I will check the names submitted to me. And the ones I target for destruction, I will put a check next to them. And the ones that are not targeted, I won't. Wow. Holy Toledo. Mmm. Gosh. Peter Hart, writing at fair.org, says, whatever the faults with how Chris Hayes phrased his original comments, and I frankly don't find any, the point he was making was that the automatic, uncritical rhetoric about war heroism can serve to constrain discussions about war policy. He was not at all callous or flippant in making the case, as he says at the end. And he added at the end, I could be wrong. Chris Hayes added that. And as Peter says, if anything, the critical feedback seems to have convinced him that he was wrong. There's no indication that Chris Hayes was pressured by MSNBC management. He says the decision was his own. Uh-huh.
against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. I'm having a hard time just getting used to the idea that nobody on MSNBC really has challenged how Obama's prosecuting of the so-called war on terror differs from the Bush administration. How they identify people who are targeted for assassination. I thought MSNBC was establishing itself as the liberal news channel. Well, it is, but the rules say you just don't question the national security state. You just don't do it. Let me see. The Daily Advertiser. That is a newspaper in, where is this? In Baton Rouge, somewhere in Louisiana. The Daily Advertiser. I don't think it's in a big city. Well, I guess it is. It's a Gannett-owned paper, serving central Louisiana. And it's standing by its decision to run an advertisement today. So it's already run, in which a far-right extremist group suggests that Barack Obama and the Democrats are conspiring to murder Catholics and Christians. Should say Catholics and Protestants, right? The ad shows a photograph of a Catholic priest who was shot and killed in Mexico in the 1920s and suggests that President Obama and the Democrats would do the same. Let me read the ad to you. I have a picture of it. It shows a firing squad and a priest up against the wall with his, you know, the typical priestly garb of the 20s. A letter to Louisiana and America. Will Obama and the Democrats shoot Catholics and Christians? You know, you can tell right away, just the rock bottom, goddamn stupid ignorance of the people who put this together. Anyway, this historical photo depicts Father Francisco Vera, a Catholic priest from the town of Jalisco, Mexico, standing before a firing squad in 1927. Father Vera was arrested and executed for secretly celebrating Mass. And then the ad goes on to say, I hope that the upcoming film, I can't read it then, will remind us of the true cost of religious freedom. Let us ask these Mexican martyrs to intercede before God in our own times. Long live Christ the King. America is under siege by the same evil Obama and Democrats, as history shows over and over. See the stunning expose documentary to be educated and empowered. Agenda Grinding America Down. That's the name of it, I guess. Available online or from us. Blah, 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 blah. For greater glory. Blah, blah, blah. Rah, rah. They're going to kill Catholics and Christians. Obama and the Democrats. Now, the owner... Or I should say that the paper's president and publisher, Karen Lincoln, told Think Progress that the newspaper stood by its decision to run the ad. Karen Lincoln said, we look at all of the ads, and the decision is made by each market. This ad did meet our standards. The decision to run it was approved. Karen Lincoln says that another ad from the same organization will run in Saturday's paper. Huh? So Karen Lincoln says, pay attention. We look at all the ads and the decision is made by each market. This ad did meet our standards. Our standards say that Obama is going to kill Christians and Catholics. We have standards. Jesus Christ. God, we live in asylum. And Mike Elk, This also from fair.org. You heard about Mike Elk, reporter for In These Times. There's a video out there at, I think it's at fair.org. It might be at Think Progress. It might be one of the other places, but you can find it. Just look for Mike Elk, E-L-K. And he had, what happened was he had his microphone ripped out of his hand yesterday when he asked the CEO of Honeywell about his company's business practices. I'll tell you more about this when we come back. Stay with us.
Against right-wing rhetoric, get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. So Mike Elk, who is a labor reporter for the newspaper In These Times, or magazine In These Times, was attending this forum on Capitol Hill where David Cote, the CEO of Honeywell, was taking some questions. Now, Cote has close ties to the Obama administration, and Obama appeared at a Honeywell plant today. But at this forum yesterday, he was the guest of a Republican congressman, David Cote was. Now, there was a question and answer period, and Mike Elk, who used to work for the Huffington Post, stood up and began asking Mr. Cote about anti-union practices at Honeywell, and also started asking him about a recent radioactive gas leak at one of Honeywell's plants. A videographer for Republic Report filmed what happened next. And as Michael continued his questions, you can see in the video, a man in a suit kept trying to lunge for his microphone. And you can only guess it was somebody either on the payroll of Honeywell or someone hired as a contractor by Honeywell. Eventually, this thug, there were three of them, actually. I saw three bald-headed thugs, you know, big dudes, the ones that are hired to intimidate, two white guys and a black guy, trying to intimidate this reporter. And eventually, the white thug yanked it out of Mike Elk's hands, the microphone. And Elk said, "I'm a member of the press. I've never been treated like this in Washington." And then a woman journalist who was sitting on her ass in the audience, listening and not challenging anything that David Cote was saying. This woman said, "Show your press credentials." And you can hear Mike Elk say, "They're right here." And then the woman said, "That's not a member of the press from Capitol Hill. You have no..." Yeah. Security then moved on in on Mike Elk. "You have no right to touch me," he said to them. So here's a guy who was escorted out. He was asking a question about a radioactive gas leak and the anti-union tactics and position of Honeywell. A member of his own profession tells him essentially to sit down and shut up. "Don't ask tough questions. What the hell's wrong with you? You don't have any right. You don't have any credentials." Speaking to Huffington Post after the incident, Mike Elk said he was then pushed by security. When he tried to approach David Coate outside the event, Elk said, "I chased him out of the back door to a fire exit. They wouldn't let me through. I go around to another door and see the Honeywell CEO running away from me. A Honeywell guy pushes me back from the door. I'm like, hey, man, you can't block a fire exit. I started yelling at him, telling him I'm going to call the police." So, I mean, are you seeing a pattern here? This is so typical. This is so typical. Poor Chris Hayes, whose work I really like, forced to apologize for something he didn't say. Keith Olbermann banished. Dan Rather dumped. I mean, just go right down the list. How many times have you seen this now? Reporters who are intimidated not just by the capitalists that they're trying to get answer from, but the hired thugs that surround them to protect them from these kinds of questions. They're none of your goddamn business. What do you mean? Radioactive gas leak. What do you care? Go write something about the deer. Go write something about swimming at the beach this summer. What do you mean a radioactive gas leak? How dare you ask me that question? And then oddly, in The Nation that I just received, lead article, can journalists be jailed? And The Nation says an important question of whether the military may hold U.S. citizens and foreign nationals in indefinite detention came to a head recently in two important forums, a federal court in Manhattan and the House of Representatives. On May 16th, U.S. District Judge Catherine Forrest ruled unconstitutional an important section of the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, for fiscal year 2012, finding that it threatened U.S. citizens with military detention for First Amendment-protected speech and association. What? That's in the appropriations bill. That's in the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2012. Now, 2 days later, taking up the NDAA for 2013, the House rejected a rare bipartisan proposal to bar the military detention of people apprehended on U.S. soil. And at the same time, it approved language that appeared to mandate that all foreign nationals who can be tried in a military commission must be tried there rather than in civilian criminal court. The Nation points out that these developments underscore the remarkable fact that more than 10 years after the September 11 attacks, the scope of the government's power to use military authority to lock up human beings indefinitely remains fundamentally unclear. Indeed, it was that very ambiguity that led the judge to rule an important part of the NDAA unconstitutional. Now, when you couple this with, by the way, as you may or may not know, Chris Hedges, Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, and several other journalists and activists are suing the federal government where it concerns the NDAA, claiming that the law was so overboard and vague, they feared that their writings and their associations might lead the government to lock them up in military detention. Huh? Now, at first, Hedges and the rest of them were told that they didn't have standing in this case. In other words, they were not an aggrieved party. That's what the administration's lawyers argued. And Obama's lawyers had several facts in their favor. No one in Hedges or Chomsky's position had been placed in military detention. The law on its face said it did not expand detention authority over U.S. citizens, and the president said he would not use military detention against Americans. But when pressed by the judge at a hearing on the case, the government's lawyer obstinately refused to assure the plaintiffs that they were free to engage in their conduct without being confined in military brig. Do you understand that? The Obama administration appeared to want to keep its options open. The Obama administration lawyers would not categorically state that Chris Hedges, Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, and people who do what we do on this program would not have any chance of being confined to a military brig. How about that? Now, that was what led the judge to conclude that the plaintiffs in this case, Hedges and Chomsky and Ellsberg, had a reasonable fear that they might be subjected to the law. Now, if they can't be subjected, the judge said, it would be very simple for the government to say so. So she ruled that the government does have the power to detain, but such a significant power must be subject to narrower and more clearly articulated limits. So the judge preliminarily barred the law's enforcement against these three guys. And of course, the Obama administration is definitely going to appeal. And you don't really think the Obama administration is as fascist-leaning as the Bush administration? Really? You really think you're dealing with a liberal or a progressive where it concerns President Obama? Do you really? Show me where. Have you got anything you can hold up and say, here, Mike, here, look here, look here. Do you have anything? Or is it just that feeling you've got, the same feeling that I get every time I hear Obama speak? And I'm sitting there, I'm going, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, preach, brother, preach. You got anything besides that? We'll be right back.
Day Screaming with Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. By the way, Andy Caffrey is going to join us after the break at the top of the hour. You know, he's running for Congress from Northern California. Last time he was on, we didn't talk about his marijuana thing. We will chat with him about that and also... he sent an email to Kathy and said one of the things we should talk about is Mike's general critique that there's absolutely nothing positive or important that can be done in any context with the Republican or Democratic parties. He says, I fully agree with him, with my project being the only one and the only exception so far. This is a really important area for us all to be thinking about. So we're going to talk with Andy again coming up after the top of the hour. You remember on Sunday there were reports of a NATO airstrike in the eastern Paktia province of Afghanistan. The earlier reports said that a family of eight was killed. And the New York Times reported it this way. Quote, the casualties took place in eastern Paktia province on Saturday night when the family's home was hit by a bomb, said Rohala Samoon, a spokesman for the governor of Paktia. Six children were killed, four boys and two girls, as well as their mother and father, whose name was Safiullah. End quote. However, this according to fair.org, Peter Hart, again at fair.org. If you don't go to that website, you should. Peter writes, an Associated Press report that appeared in the Washington Post on the 28th, 3 days, 4 days ago, 5 days ago, looked very different from what the Times first reported, thanks mostly to anonymous officials who aren't waiting for any investigation to get out their side of the story. This is how the AP reported in the Washington Post on May 28th, quote, the U.S.-led coalition on Sunday disputed reports that eight civilians, including children, were killed in a NATO airstrike in a remote part of eastern Afghanistan. Afghan officials said the airstrike Saturday night killed eight members of a family, but a senior NATO official said there is no evidence of civilian casualties. No. The official spoke on conditions of anonymity because he was not authorized to disclose the information. It never happened. And who says it never happened? Well, anonymous. Now, as FAIR reports, the piece moves from there to reporting on NATO coalition deaths. A reminder, one might conclude, of which lives might matter more. The six children and their mother and father, or NATO soldiers. So, when the story of the dead family is reported by AP a little bit further, the AP reminds readers, quote, the killing of civilians by foreign forces has been a major irritant in Afghan President Hamid Karzai's relationship with his international partners. End quote. That's an interesting way of putting it. An irritant. What do you want to bet it's more of an irritant to the families of those who are murdered? You think? The Associated Press also reminds readers that the truth, in such instances, always wins out. The AP says, quote, Afghan and coalition officials frequently offer differing accounts of military operations. When local residents report that civilians were killed, the coalition says the victims had been identified as insurgents. Insurgents. Later, if investigations prove that civilians were inadvertently killed, the coalition acknowledges its mistake. Well, that's certainly a massive goddamn relief, isn't it? Oh, we're sorry. It looks like we did kill another six children and their parents. Darn. Oh, and Mr. President Hamid Karzai, we're not trying to be irritating. How much money do you want for this latest example of U.S. aggression? How much? What do we agree to? $7,000 a person? More for the kids? Well, the kid, you know, the kids, they would have lived longer. So, you know, they could have earned an extra, well, if they would have lived to age 70, they could probably earn an extra $100. After all, it is Afghanistan, right? So, what do you think they're worth, Mr. President? This is what we do now. Does it upset you? No? Yes? It does upset you? Well, not to worry. It's not your family member who ordered the drone strike and wiped out, if you want to believe those damn villagers, six children and their mother and father. It wasn't your brother or mom or sister or dad who pushed the button. So it doesn't affect you. Go back to whatever you were doing. And don't worry about it. You know, stuff happens. Like Stalin said, when you chop wood, chips fly. Oh, did you hear about George W. Bush's portrait was unveiled? Oh, yeah, I think we talked about that. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. If you aren't getting the It is 7 past the hour. The Malloy Program. A couple of weeks ago, we talked with Andy Caffrey. I think it was a couple of weeks ago. Andy Caffrey, who is running for Congress in the California 2nd, I believe. And he's running as a different kind of candidate. Well, he's back at our invitation. Hey, Andy.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
How's everything in Garberville?
It's delightful today. Beautiful.
All right, let's just get right to it. You know, the other night I was talking about the NOAA has now come up with the number 400 parts per minute, parts per million of carbon dioxide in the Arctic Circle. And that's the only place where it has reached that high of a number. But we've been told for a couple of for several years now that the polar regions is where it's going to accelerate the quickest. What is your take on the 400 ppm?
Well, I'll give you an example. It was about 285 before the Industrial Revolution. I'm 54 years old, and when I was born, it was 315. Right, so that's about 30 above it. And now we're up to 400. So in my lifetime, it's gone from 315 to 400.
How much more of this can the Earth's atmosphere take before there's a, I don't know, let's pick a word, collapse?
Well, you know, I can't give you an answer for that, but I can tell you that something like the breakup of Greenland or West Antarctica's ice sheets could happen any year. It's just something that it's they've been moving up from something that might happen 1,000 years from now to something that's going to happen probably between now and 2050, and that's the established scientists.
So, you know, we talk about the apocalyptic visions based on science every at least two or three times a week. Whether it is what happened in Fukushima or whether it is global climate change or the whatever these potential really extinction level event disasters are. So rather than talk about that, what can we do to turn this around? I mean, I need somebody to tell me something.
Well, it's been 30 years since I first heard about global warming, and I found out about it from the scientist who started measuring it. And not long after that is when the politicians found out about it. A lot of people say 1988 is when James Hansen presented it to Congress, and they've done nothing. So the first thing we have to recognize, just as we have about what monsters people like the Bush administration are, is to get clear on what the plight is that we're facing. And basically my conclusion is that we're not safe until we get it back down to historic levels, and by that I mean levels that we've been in for the last 2 million years. And that means getting it back down to 280 parts per million or so. Now, we can't do that in a few years, but I'm saying that's got to be the target, not this 350 nonsense, because it just has not been that high in the last 2 million years. So,
wait, let me just ask you, isn't that 350 target a reasonable target given what the situation is now? This is what Bill McKibben talks about. That, I mean, you have to come down to something, and to go from 400 down to the 285, given where we are globally with China, India, the United States, the European Union, the emerging mega societies in South America, it's not going to get back to 285. It's just not going to go there, Andy.
Okay, well, here's the deal then. If you're sitting on the beach and a tsunami's coming and you wait until you see it before you start to run and get away, you're just as dead if you didn't leave early enough and get far enough away as the guy who stayed on the beach.
Right.
So it's kind of like if somebody's a cocaine addict and they say, I only want to cut back 10%. Well, they're not going to make themselves healthy, are they? So that's the thing. It's like the revolution, you know. At a certain point, there's a paradigm shift where everyone just says, this is not acceptable. Absolutely unacceptable. And enough people are talking about what's going on that they come together. And we have this potential with the Occupy movement to have this kind of conversation all across the country.
Well, I get that. And I think anybody that still has a few screws that haven't come completely loose also get that. But to get that kind, excuse me, to get that kind of reaction from a brain dead human species who just is not willing or interested in hearing about this is going to take millions upon millions upon millions of people in the street. Chris Hedges has been talking about this. I'm sure you've talked about it. I've talked about it. Chomsky's talked about it. Everybody's talking about it. That are trying to get people to understand the criticality of all of this. But how do you really get them to walk out the front door and go down to Main Street, whatever town they live in, and sit down in the middle of the goddamn street and just sit there and say, okay, I'm not moving until this stops? How do you inspire people to do that?
You have to pick a fight for the people who are in the way.
That's
what my campaign's about. You know, imagine, you know, what is it we could actually do in Congress? Well, what if we had 20 Michael Moores and Amy Goodmans as a start, who were simply every day telling America what's really going on, like you do? Okay, what if you were in there? What if there were 20 Mike Malloys in there? At the very least, just they couldn't get bills passed, but at least they could start talking truth to power, you know, that old 60s term.
Sure.
That's the first thing we can do. Now, the thing is, I can't promise that we have a solution. I can just tell you the best directions we can go to have the best chance of doing it, and I think we have to do it if we have any moral scruples at all and care about our kids and grandkids, even if we don't see how it happens. And I say this because I have been involved in projects before where we never had a clue that we were going to be successful, and we were. And you've watched, as I have, the Berlin Wall fall, apartheid end. These things can happen. And what you have to do is increase the forces that make it likely. And I'm saying, you know, once in a while, there's that Woodstock moment where people come together and something transcendental happens. Now, of course, I don't want to overplay Woodstock, but you know what I mean.
Sure. It's the Woodstock attitude. What did you mean when you wrote to Kathy and said, Mike's general critique that there's absolutely nothing, all caps, positive or important that could be done in any context with the Republican or Democratic parties? I fully, totally, completely believe that. And I would imagine you do too.
I do. Yep, that's right. So the thing is, now, okay, we talked about Norman Solomon. There's a difference in strategy that we're using. He's using the Dennis Kucinich, Raul Grijalva, I'm going to try to get in there as a progressive Democrat and do it the traditional way of raising a lot of money, getting, you know, billboards and all that literature and stuff. I'm saying that we don't have to raise the money, so we don't have to make those compromises. Because, you know, if Norman gets in there 2 years from now, he's going to need the favors of these people he's using right now, which means how much is he going to confront them? And Norman's a good guy. but I've been able to see that, you know, he pulls his punches. I'm the only one who said empire. We have to end the empire. He just talks about bringing the boys home. So it's a very hard thing to be a candidate. You know, I basically think he's just a little awkward. He's doing the best he can, and he doesn't have confidence as a grassroots organizer that he can do what I think I can do, which is to reach as many people using the internet, radio shows, community meetings, debates, and my own media, which right now, as I mentioned in the letter, I've just put out my fourth commercial, which is a TV commercial. It's going to be on Letterman Monday night and Face the Nation Sunday morning and these other shows, Charlie Rose's morning show. And it's got me smoking a joint at that first event where I smoked the joint. And then at the end, when it says, I'm Andy Caffrey and I approve this message, you hear the sound of a bong burgling.
Now, Jesus.
Wait a minute, Andy.
I mean, you know, I love it, and I'm sure most of the people listening to the program loves it, but really? I mean, you're going to have a commercial like that, and who will it inspire?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, people are really proud of me for taking the stand for medical marijuana and attacking Obama
yes.
for closing the clinics.
Yes.
So that is the foundation of our economy in four of the six counties.
Right.
So there's that number of people. Then there's the youth. You know, we're talking about the climate here. Other candidates aren't getting into this, and the youth know who is talking about what matters to their future.
Right. Okay, so what you're saying, in the local markets where the second congressional district, these commercials are going to run during the programs that you mentioned. That's what you're saying, right?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Hold on a second, Andy. I got to do some, I'll take some breaks here so the local stations can do their commercials. Just stay right there if you would. We're talking to Andy Caffrey. Cafferty, who's running in the second congressional district in California to bring some sense to survival. We'll be right back. Cafferty, who is running for Congress in California's 2nd District in the northern part of the state. All right, well, I get your point then about you have how many counties? Five counties, and four of them, marijuana is the number one product?
Correct. Well, actually, it could be half the economy.
Right, I get
three
you.
Of those six.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, and that's so true all over the country. I remember 28 years ago, I did a story on the marijuana growers here in Georgia and for Atlanta Magazine. And back then, it was considered in Georgia to be about a $2 billion business. God knows what it is now. This is, you know, it really is amazing that we are where we are in this country where it concerns these crazed marijuana laws. I just can't. You know, I've kind of dealt with this on whatever level I've dealt with it my entire life. I'm sure you have, too.
Sure. Well, let me explain a little bit about the ad, because, you see, it's okay. Not really a crazy ad that you might think from how I described it. What's happened with me using this marijuana hook is that all these reporters, you know, I've been on two MSNBC shows, and Leno made a joke about me and stuff. They're all talking about my pledge to smoke a joint on the Capitol steps. And they get me in to talk about that. And then what I talk about is no one should spend another hour in jail for marijuana crimes. The suffering of people who cannot get access to their medicine because President Obama is shutting down the dispensaries, the dignity issues around having to hide the fact that you consume marijuana as your medicine, and also about women who are losing their kids at birth because THC is found in their system and the counties get $15,000 if those kids go into foster care. So when I talk about that, suddenly Everyone on the left is listening. Watch the two shows on MSNBC and you'll see what I mean. They don't make fun of me for being a stoner or anything else. Even Leno's joke. It was a politician's joke. It wasn't a stoner joke. And he used it, I think, as an excuse to lay out what my whole thing was about. I mean, he just laid this description out before he even got to the joke. So what's happened is, this is a message that people are in tune with now. We can do something bigger than Occupy. I think we can even get the dispensary raids shut down by November by pressuring Obama, because after I was on TV, Tom Hartman for 2 days went off on how horrible it was what Obama was doing on the medical marijuana issue. Mm-hmm. And he basically set it up so Obama has got to do for medical marijuana what he did for gay marriage. And I agree with that entirely. That's what we should be pushing for. And we have these Republicans who think we should legalize it. Our economy is $2 to $3 billion in Humboldt County alone for marijuana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, across the United States, we're looking at probably the largest cash crop going, unless you consider some of the these mega factory farms where they slaughter animals. But it is a massive business. Now, how does the legalization of marijuana equal a turnaround in some of these critical issues that we're facing?
Okay, well, the first interview I did on Lawrence O'Donnell's show was just about marijuana. The second one started with Alex Wagner doing a summary of my 7 points, the New Green America thing. So what's happening is, as these people like me, after each show, the producer says, oh, we want to have you back real soon. Each time I go on, I can expand that. I'm going to get into talking about Monsanto and GMOs and the climate crisis next. Those are the two main things I'm going to expand it to. So it's a matter of, you know, my background is as a media activist. Earth First is really a media group. It's not really a monkey wrenching group. We just do things to get people to look at things. So we make a big splash. And that's why people do tree climbing and bulldozer stuff. So what we have to do is recognize that we have to get attention. And some of the things that I've learned in my campaign are really useful for folks who aren't even running for office. For example, cable access TV. We had debates in all 6 counties. Probably 20 of them I went to. I got to speak in front of maybe 5,000 progressive Democrats, something I never could have done before. And what's happening is the different county cable access stations are linking up. So that's something you can start doing in your own congressional district around issues, to start to get in sync with your cable access thing. If you can have a community radio station, start doing a show on that. Part of my reputation was built around doing a homelessness radio show. So when I started to run for Congress, at least in Humboldt and northern Mendocino, I was known for doing that work. So people just don't tend to think that much in terms of media, but you have to get focused on what has to happen. And that's why I have that list, those 7 things on New Green America. Check those things out, people, and see if you can get behind that, too.
That's at your website.
That's at my website, and it's the very first thing there, and there's also a flyer.
All right. Andy, we're out of time yet again. How about checking back in with us in a couple of weeks? It's CAFRE, C-A-F-F-R-E-Y, CAFREforCongress.org. Good luck, Andy. Stay in touch.
One other website, yeah. Mike, is the YouTube channel. It's got all these debates and stuff. They're fantastic debates. It's youtube.com/CAFRE for Congress.
Okay, CAFRE for Congress at YouTube. All right, thanks, Andy.
Thank you, Mike.
All right, take care. We'll talk again. Andy CAFRE, California 2nd. Check him out on YouTube and CAFRE. There's no T in it, just CAFRE for Congress.org. Stay with us.
Maybe we should help the fiend and take away his spot. But we're busy reading Playboy and the Sunday New York Times, and I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends. Smoking marijuana is more fun than drinking beer, but a friend of ours was captured and they gave him 30 years. Maybe we should raise our voices, ask somebody why. Demonstrations are a drag, besides we're much too high, and I'm sure it wouldn't interest.
This is for all the lonely people.
Has he mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people? It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Coming up after the next break, we're going to do podcast trivia. That means in about 15 minutes, you'll have a chance to win a one-year subscription to Malloy Show podcasts, commercial-free, downloads in your somewhere in your email every morning. And all I have to do is call in, answer the correct or answer the multiple choice question correctly, and you win. Last night in the third hour of the program, and I wanted to do it earlier, so that means I've got to do this right now. I mentioned a progressive newspaper in L.A., and then I realized that L.A. KTLK only carries 2 hours of our program. So for you listeners in L.A., you're probably familiar with this. They distribute about 10,000 of them around Los Angeles. It's the Change Links progressive newspaper, Change-Links progressive newspaper. The guy who runs it, John Johnson, it's a one-person operation. And he started sending me a free subscription a couple of years ago to the P.O. box. And every time I get one, I can't help it. I read it. I used to work in the alternative press. I used to work for the Great Speckled Bird here in Atlanta, which back in the day was called Radical Voice from the South. I can tell you stories about that, about phone call monitoring by the FBI back when you could hear the click, click, clicks. And then we got firebombed and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, this Changelings progressive newspaper reminds me a lot of some of these 60s and 70s style progressive newspapers that are always struggling, always trying to hold on by their fingernails. They also have a website, though, which makes this different from the radical newspapers back in the 60s and 70s, obviously. And their website is change-links, it's plural, L-A-N-K-S, change-links.org. So if you live in L.A., would you, and if you don't, I mean, you don't have to live there. I just want folks in L.A. to know about this if you don't already. 10,000 copies in a city of, how big is Los Angeles? 6-7 million? That's not, it's not a lot of copies out there. He would put 100,000 if he could. He'd put 1 million if he could. Same problem we used to have when I worked in the alternative press. It's just a constant struggle. Not only do you have a hard time finding advertising support, there's always plenty of people who write for leftist media. Oh my God! But getting it out, distributing it, handling all the stuff that goes into putting out a progressive paper, there's a lot of work. All right. No kidding. So what I want you to do, if you live in L.A., I want you to subscribe to this paper or pick up a copy. They're free at the I'm sure he has boxes out like we used to. Go to the website. You can get a subscription, which gets it mailed to your house, your apartment, your door, your P.O. box, whatever. Or at least go to his website. Give him some website traffic. That now makes all the difference in the world. It's just the traffic. I mean, go there, okay? And support this guy, John Johnson, change-links.org. Change-links.org. It's the Change Links progressive newspaper, and it's a good one. So do it for Uncle Mike, all right? Uncle Mike? Just do it, please. I don't ask that much. I'm asking you to do that. Change-links.org. And look for it. If you live in L.A., look for it. And you can get his mailing address at the website, and you can have your very own subscription mailed to you. I've got kind of a interesting trivia question coming up for you when we come back from this next break. I hope you get it. Michael in Oregon City wrote to me. He caught my attention. The subject line says death. Oh, no. So I open it up. Mike, it's been a while since I've written, but rest assured, I'm still alive in our romper room nation. Been listening to some shows from Wednesday and Thursday this week, and out of pure outrage, I feel compelled to share a thought or two. I also voted for Hope and Change, but was screwed out of both. Now I find out he runs death squads out of the Oval Office, and any poor sap caught in the blast radius is just as guilty. when the drones go off? Let me ask you to scream this aloud to Prairie 2 and the plethora of Obama apologists who constantly defend him. No, I can't say that on the air, Michael. I have had the displeasure of burying both of my daughters within the past decade. My second one just this last September. I'm sorry to hear that. I also served in the military for 9 years. And trust me when I tell you this, I've yet to meet a friggin' hero. Death by drones or SEALs, be it collateral or not, is death. Remove from it any aspect of due process and oversight, and you've got murder. Plain and simple. Recently, my 72-year-old father asked my opinion about the future of our country. I told him the politicians and rich have taken our houses, our retirements, our education, our future, and soon enough, our access to health care. They have been generous enough to provide ample alcohol, mind-numbing prescriptions, strange and powerful narcotics, and many, many, many guns. You tell me the future of this nation. I had hope that Obama would at least not be as murderous as Bush. Silly me. Yours always, Michael in Oregon City. Ow. Ow about the losing two daughters. Damn, Michael. Gary's in Minneapolis listening on KTNF. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Mike. Hey. I just want to tell you, I'm the first of the baby boomers. My father came back from the Second World War. I was born in 46. And I'm just so tired of my generation in particular wanting to destroy the middle class, how Reagan was. Mm-hmm. At least Minnesota was the only state that didn't vote for him. But this guy was on, I forget what program, Jennifer Granholm, I guess. Uh-huh. He wrote a book about the millennials born between 82 and 2012.
Yeah.
And it was so refreshing to hear how they're so much different than my generation, especially the white voters and stuff and the white people. And he gave some statistics about how that 40% of them are non-white. And they grew up with these immigrants, and 20% of them are Latinos. And all these Republican attacks, like on women's birth control and immigrants and gay rights, they're really turned off by this crap. I'm so sick of all this poverty that my generation was the biggest supporter of this stuff, the baby boomers, of killing the unions and creating this poverty. And I'm just... it's just refreshing to hear these baby boomers. And the two biggest things that will get for voter turnout for the millennials is jobs and the economy, and the other one is, what was the other one? Education. And they're all in student loan debt. I know this millennial, and she wants to be a therapist, and because I have bipolar illness, she helps me, and she's $60,000 in student loan debt. I think it's just terrible what they did to education in this country.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. I don't know what happened either, Gary. It's almost like, I don't know. It's almost like, I don't know how to put it in words. Capitalism went crazy and has destroyed everything. Globalization has destroyed everything. The idea of small businesses supporting each other, a decent, prosperous, mid-level, income and way of life based on small businesses, small factories, small family farms. I don't know what happened to that idea, except the capitalists took over. They took over everything. Mom and pop stores became Walmart. A mom and pop and three or four generation farms became factory farms.
Yeah.
You know, little steel mills that would employ 100 people became United States Steel. It's just
I grew up in unions, you know, and well, my political heroes are still the ones that were my younger, the Kennedys, you know, John Kennedy in particular, and Walter Reuther and Hubert Humphrey and
John. You know, don't forget John L. Lewis, the United Mine Workers, the guy who, remember John L. Lewis with those great big bushy eyebrows and
CIO, right?
Oh my God!
Reuther was so good because he took on Ford and they knocked the crap out of him. They had that picture went around the world and you know Ford they always talk about his positive stuff, but he had 5,000 company thugs that knocked the crap out of the workers, and they had to get permission just to use the toilet and stuff.
Right. Plus Henry Ford was a well-known Nazi sympathizer, like so many industrialists back in the 30s in this country were. Hey, listen, Gary, thank you. I'm tired of the bigotry as you are. I wish the boomer generation would not have turned out to be so self-centered and self-referential and unable to face what has to be taken care of. So we're in a world of hurt for sure. Gary, thanks a lot, man. We'll talk again. Podcast trivia. So if you want to get online, now's the time. 877-996-2556. Come on, let's do it. Let's do it. Get the right answer, you win a one-year subscription to Malloy program podcast downloads, commercial free. All you have to do is, get the right answer. Did I say all you have to do is get the right answer? All right, let's give it a shot here. Ben is in Buena Park, California. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right, Ben, you ready?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. What notable politician recently praised Mitt Romney's business career as sterling and criticized President Obama's negative campaign ads aimed at Romney's tenure as CEO of Bain Capital? All right, let me say it again. What notable politician may have been today, praised Mitt Romney's business career as sterling and criticized Obama's negative campaign ads aimed at Romney's of being CEO at Bain Capital? Was it A, George W. Bush, B, Donald Trump, C, Rick Santorum, or D, Bill Clinton?
Oh, none of the answers I was expecting came on the list. Can you read the list again?
George W. Bush, Donald Trump, Rick Santorum, Bill Clinton.
Oh, let's see. I'd say...
Now, this is somebody who criticized or who supported Romney for his wonderful work at Bain Capital and criticized Obama for making an issue out of it.
I would most likely say, who is the C answer again?
A, George Bush, B, Donald Trump, C, Rick Santorum, or D, Bill Clinton?
I wanted to say C, but I'm going to go with Donald Trump.
And no, it's not. Ow! It's not Donald Trump. But thanks, Ben. I appreciate it. All right. Brian is in Beverly Hills. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
You ready to give this a shot?
Sure. That is a hard one, though, but I'm going to have to say George Bush.
Okay, here we go. Let me restate the question again. What notable politician recently praised, I think it was today, praised Mitt Romney's business acumen as sterling and criticized Obama's negative campaign ads aimed at Romney's tenure as CEO of Bain Capital? Was it A, George Bush, B, Donald Trump, C, Rick Santorum, or D, Bill Clinton?
I'm
going to
say George Bush.
No, wasn't George Bush. I'm sorry. Gosh darn it. This is not hard. All right, let's get another player on the line here. Yeah, everybody in the Malloy chat room has it. We see you, but you're not playing, all right? This really is not a hard one, folks. You should be able to figure it out fairly quickly. I guess it is hard. Well, I'm saying it's not hard because I know the answer. But if you don't know the answer, obviously it's going to be hard. What? What the hell does that mean? All right. We are waiting here for another player. I think we have one. Monica in San Diego. Hi, Monica.
Hello.
All right. You ready to rock and roll with this?
Yes, I am.
Okay, let me give you the question again. What notable politician recently praised Mitt Romney and said his career as CEO of Bain Capital was sterling and criticized Obama for his negative campaign ads aimed at Romney's tenure at Bain Capital? Who was that? Was it A, George W. Bush, B, Donald Trump, C, Rick Santorum, or D, Bill Clinton?
D, Bill Clinton.
You're right! Okay. Unbelievable. Thank you. All right, Monica, I'm going to put you on hold. Stay there. Kathy will get the pertinent information from you before we go to the or during the break. Now, here's what Clinton said vis-a-vis Romney's career at Bain. Quote, "I don't think we ought to get in a position where we say this is bad work. This is good work." How many of you still think that Bill Clinton, if you ever did think this, is a progressive or a liberal or even a Democrat? Huh? I mean, does something like this shake? Now, the right-wing trolls who couldn't find their ass with both hands and a compass, this is way over their heads. But I'm talking about normal people. This is Bill Clinton. This is the guy that signed off on NAFTA. This is a guy that signed off on so-called welfare reform that immediately created a massive underclass of people who will never find work because of the way capitalism and globalization work. This is Bill Clinton, one of the most powerful forces of destruction where it concerns economics this country has ever experienced. That Bill Clinton. And then he went on. He said, "There's no question that in terms of getting up and going to the office, and, you know, basically performing the essential functions of the office, a man who's been governor and had a sterling business career crosses the qualification threshold." Really? Thus spake Zarathustra. I'm sorry. Thus spake Bill Clinton. Now, I'll leave it to you to try to figure out why Clinton would be deliberately sabotaging Obama. Is this payback? Remember, during the Hillary Clinton-Barack Obama race for the Democratic Party nomination, remember what Bill Clinton said about Barack Obama. That the whole thing was smoke and mirrors. Well, as it turned out, of course, Clinton was correct. But Bill Clinton was worse than smoke and mirrors. Bill Clinton, like so many of these people, is a goddamn liar. He's a capitalist. He's a multimillionaire, if not a billionaire at this point. He doesn't care. He doesn't now. He didn't then. He never will. We'll be back after the break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. You know, I have no problem, contrary to what it may have sounded like, I have no problem with Bill Clinton jumping up and smacking Barack Obama's campaign across the cheek. This is what Bill Clinton does. I don't think there's a more vindictive politician than Bill Clinton, and probably stems from the fact that he had such a hard time keeping his zipper zipped, and he finally got caught in a perjury trap. The psychotic Republicans went after him in 98. It was pretty bad. But he survived very nicely, didn't he? Of course, by then he had done all the damage he could possibly do. But Liz Marlantes, who wrote this at the Christian Science Monitor, says Clinton's comments weren't just off message. They were a declaration of war on the message. And she says they underscore a fundamental split within the Democratic Party that's less about Romney's record of Bain than it is about whether the Democratic Party as a whole is perceived as a friend or foe of Wall Street and the world of business and high finance. Now, it just so happens that the world of business and high finance is a capitalist sump of poison and destruction. Because I say so? Oh, please, take a look at what it's done. Take a look at what it has done to us, done to this country, done to Europe, and soon we'll do the same to the rest of the world. Just take a look. And as Liz writes, remember, Clinton went to great lengths as president to make the Democratic Party appear more pro-business than it had in decades, supporting so-called free trade, which is a meme that is a goddamn lie, and most all of us know that now, ending welfare as we know it, remember that, and in the process, condemning hundreds of thousands of people to living on the street, including children and single mothers. That was old Bill Clinton. And explicitly, Clinton courted more affluent supporters, particularly on Wall Street. And look who runs the government now. Look at Barack Obama's top economic advisors. Do you see Paul Krugman? Do you see any of the economists who understand that the attack being waged right now is going to bring the entire system down? No, neither do I. So anyway, as Liz Marlante says at the Wall Street Journal, since Clinton, Democratic candidates have seemed to push the party back toward a more explicit economic populism or appeared to demonize big business. That was what was going on. Clinton has often signaled his disapproval. After Al Gore ran on the slogan, the people versus the powerful, and in 2000 and lost, but he didn't lose, did he? Clinton later commented that he thought Gore's message hadn't worked. You see how these people do this? Do you see this? Gore's message had nothing to do with it. It was the Supreme Court, put there by right-wingers, who stopped the vote counting. And Bill Clinton has the balls to say, well, Al Gore had the wrong message. And Liz Marlantes has the misdirection to say Al Gore lost in 2000, and then she adds parenthetically, though barely. No, he didn't lose. He won. But anyway, Liz goes on, Obama's relationship with Wall Street and the business community has undergone a notable shift between this campaign and the last, and the president's message has taken on a more stridently populist tone. Really? I know his speeches have that, Ms. Marlantes, but his policies don't reflect that tone. She writes, while the last Obama campaign was about creating a new postpartisan era of government, this one is centered on economic fairness, highlighting inequities in the tax code and the need for regulations and other policies that protect the little guy. How terrible, huh? Over the past 4 years, many business leaders have bristled at what they perceive as unfair attacks coming from the president. How dare he attack them? How dare anyone point out that they're a bunch of goddamn thieves, liars, cheats, sneaks? And they will cut your heart out and laugh while they hold it up in the air till it stops bleeding. You know that. How many trillions were stolen out of 401ks and home equity? How many people were conned into this? And who made money? Bill Clinton's friends. And, frankly, Barack Obama's friends. What effort has been made to save the people that got shafted? The homeowners? Anything? What has been done to help workers who are unemployed through no fault of their own? Hold on with an unemployment check. Nobody! And Bill Clinton, who sits on his bony ass on top of his millions, while his wife prances around the globe promulgating the national security state philosophy and policy. Jesus, God! Calm down. Liz Marlantes closes at Christian Science Monitor by saying Clinton's defense of Romney, or rather his implied criticism of Obama's criticism of Romney, may seem like a slap in the face to Obama. But if Clinton truly believes that economic populism is a losing strategy for Democrats, his comments may actually have been an effort, in his view, to save the Obama campaign from itself. Bill Clinton, Christ on the cross. Huh? By undercutting so publicly the Obama campaign's attacks on Romney's career, Clinton may well have permanently, and yes, somewhat humiliatingly, eliminated that line of argument from the campaign's arsenal. And we'd wager Clinton thinks he was doing them a favor. Wow. Well, you know, it doesn't matter to us, does it, what Bill Clinton thinks he was doing for the Obama campaign. The truth is, Bill Clinton is an anti-populist. It is turning out that it has turned out that Barack Obama is the same. It's all about the money in the final analysis, isn't it? It's not about keeping the planet livable. It's not about stopping the insanity that is just rippling through this species. It's not about any of that, is it? It's about the money. Show me the money. It's just so hard to deal with that. It's so hard to have any kind of process left in your head where you see that 2 + 2 + 2 really does equal 6, and they're trying to tell you that 2 + 2 + 2 doesn't equal 6. It equals something else. It equals something that hedge fund managers and derivatives people and people who are stealing you blind and ripping you off and taking everything you thought you had and your parents and your grandparents and your kids' future as they sit there and tell you, no, goddammit, 2 + 2 + 2 = 1!
My blue-eyed son, and where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains, six crooked highways. I stepped in,
and I think we're over the storm. I have been.
The revolution starts right now. Here's Mike Malloy.
I would not run from the Holocaust. I would not 21 past the hour. Welcome the chance to meet my maker and fly into the sun. Quick email here, then back to your calls. This is from Lanny the Lefty. Lanny the Lefty. All right. Lanny writes, the other night when you read that joke about the Browns rat and the Republicans, I had just heard that joke from a package a bud had sent me and got misplaced. When I moved, I just opened it and that joke was in there. Talk about synchronicity. Okay. Do you believe the Democratic Party is too far gone to be saved? We both know the GOP is straight from hell. Should we support a third party? Except for a few Democrats and Bernie Sanders, the Congress is pretty much corporatized. Are the Dems worth saving? Lanny the Lefty. We're not going to save the Democratic Party. You and I, Lanny, and millions of Americans no more have that power than we have the power to fly. The survival of the Democratic Party as a political party depends on how much money it gets from its Wall Street owners. The same is pretty much true of the Republicans. So the obvious answer is to bring this system to a conclusion. End it. Don't try to mend it. Because you're not. It's just not fixable. I mean, there is no. Seriously, if you're worried about Supreme Court justices, then go ahead and vote for Obama. Seriously, I mean, just go ahead. If you are concerned about the fact that the next president and the one after that and the one after that, if there are any more, are going to these people, these leaders are going to be just one cookie cutter after another of shoring up the capitalist 1%, continuing to crush the rest of us. Well, you know, I mean, you know what the system's going to look like. Just take a look at it now, for Christ's sake. I mean, people, open your eyes. So what do you want to do? You want to vote Democrat? Vote Democrat. You want to vote Republican? Vote Republican. If you really want things to change, then bring the system to a halt. How do you do that, Mike? You get 30 million people. Oh, Christ, what's the point? What's the point? You go back to what Mario Savio said in 1962 or 3 or 4, what was it, 62? The Sproul Hall Steps speech. Is it Sproul? I always mispronounce it. And if you look at Mario Savio's speech, you can find it. Just Google Mario Savio. There it is. You know, just find it. It's not that long. Not the part that meant anything. If you're serious, you know, just go back 50 years. 50 years? Really? Holy God. 50 years ago. And read what he said. And nobody ever did it. Was it 64? Okay, it was 64. Nobody followed up on what Mario Savio said. A lot of ego tripping, a lot of various groups put together that left wing groups that went absolutely nowhere and accomplished nothing. But if you really have gotten to the point where you want to make the machine stop, there's only one way to stop it, and you have to be willing to throw your body onto the gears. Now, that's not as bloody and gory and horrible as it sounds. You know, unless you live in a village in Afghanistan and go to sleep with your spouse and your six children, your body is already in the gears. It's just a matter of time before it crushes you and your children, right? Of course. But here in the safety of the U.S. of A., if you want to make the system change, very simple. Don't participate in it. But it can't be just you. It can't be just Chris Hedges. It can't just be Kevin Zeese. It can't be just, you know, the person down the street. It's got to be a substantial number of us. 30, 40 million. I mean, my God, that's only 10% of the population. This is no, no, no. I mean, that's what it would take. So to answer the question, do I think the Democratic Party can be saved? Two words. I'll change them just a little bit. Hell no! We're all going down.
Watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
It's 25 before the hour. Phone number is 877-996-2556. Carl is in Nashville, Tennessee. Hello, Carl.
How are you doing tonight, man? Interesting monologue. Very interesting. It's,
yeah.
Listen. What you were talking about and the reason why I called kind of ties in with each other.
Okay.
And I blame the fall of the middle class and the just the dumbed down America for the gullibleness of middle to lower class white people in America.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've allowed themselves to be pitted against other Americans.
That's right.
They've been tricked into believing if you're not for robber barons, you are an American.
Right.
And if you're not for the richest of the rich and the more fortunate of us to pay a little bit more, you are an American.
Well, that's one of the secrets, Carl. You probably know this. One of the secrets of capitalism.
Right.
You pit the different groups of workers against each other. You have them,
yeah.
You have them killing each other, so to speak. Have them undercutting each other. Tell the blacks to watch out for the whites to watch out for the blacks, the Irish to watch out for the Jews watch out for the Italians. I mean, it's the oldest trick in the book. You just keep everybody at each other's throat. In the meantime, the thieves, liars, and con men just step right in and take everything, including your goddamn soul. They get it all.
Absolutely. And frankly, just to hit on Bill Clinton real quick, I'm not surprised at anything that he do. He's very unbelievable. He's a politician. He's only out for his own.
Well, Clinton was worse than a politician. You know when people should have figured Bill Clinton out was in 1991 during his campaign, and there was a mentally retarded black guy down in Arkansas who was sentenced to death. Ricky Ray Rector.
I remember that story.
And Clinton, this miserable son of a bitch, this guy who, I don't know who said it, but he's the first black president. Whoever said that.
I get so insulted when
Well, whoever said that had done way too much drugs right before he said it. But Clinton leaves the campaign and goes back to his governor's crap hole in Little Rock and sits there and allows this guy with an IQ of about 55 or whatever it was to be executed. I think Ricky Ray Rector was the one who left part of his last meal saying, well, I'll get it in the morning.
Right.
I'm just saying about Bill Clinton. Yeah. I mean, anybody who believes in justice or honesty or truth or fairness should have taken a look at that right there and said, wait a minute.
Yeah. I mean, listen, Bill Clinton was a moderate Republican. Is not all the way a Republican. I mean, he said, basically he was trying to cut everything out of the social network, just like Republicans are trying to do. And it's amazing, you know, Alexander Pelosi did just a little thing down there in Mississippi. And this right here is the whole thing in a nutshell. She was talking to a poor white guy that's on food stamps, and she basically said, listen, your life has been hard as hell here in Mississippi, but this county right here continues to vote Republican year in and year out religiously. She said, why do you keep doing that? This guy looked right in the camera without blinking and said, it might get better.
Yeah, well.
And I'm thinking to myself, wow, there it is right there. These people have been tricked for 50 years now,
that's so true, Carl. I'm so old. I remember when they used to say, "If you want to live like a Republican, vote Democratic." Do you remember that?
Absolutely.
All right, Carl, I gotta go.
It's amazing. Hey, have a good weekend.
All right, Carl. You too. Thank you, sir. I appreciate you checking in. Take care. Take care. Kevin is in Colorado Springs. Hey, Kevin.
Good evening, Mike.
Hey.
The answer to the betrayal of people like Clinton and then Obama is that it does not come from one leader. It comes from 1 million leaders. That's been kind of the message of Occupy, that everybody is a leader. When you step out and protest, you become a leader. When we finally get it through our heads, if that's the only way to do it, then we'll have change. But if we keep depending upon one person to be our savior, it's never going to change.
Well, that's a good point. I don't believe in top-down leadership either. I used to, but until I realized that top-down leadership, I don't care what kind of a system you're operating in, is the kind of leadership that at some point, as you work your way down from the top, you have people who have no representation and no voice at all. Leadership has got to come from the bottom up. And I think the best leadership is the kind of leadership that's leaderless, where people rely on common sense and decency and a sense of justice to get things done. Now, a lot of people disagree with that and say, well, you know, you're talking about a kind of human that does not exist in the species. That's probably true, but...
Well, look at it this way. Almost 50 years ago, they killed a man by the name of Dr. Martin Luther King. And that movement, while it didn't die completely, diminished greatly. If there had been a million Dr. Martin Luther Kings, it would still be a growing movement.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, Kevin. I mean, Kevin, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate you checking in. All right, take care. Oh, boy. Mark is in San Francisco.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Mark.
How you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thanks. Yeah, this ends when we say it ends, Mike. What you've been saying is really the bottom line. When we had enough and people had enough and get out in the streets, that's the only time it's going to end.
Well, I really believe that. And It's only been in the past, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years, where I came back to that. I used to believe that back in the day when it was proven that people in the streets could influence the power structure. It didn't change the power structure, but it could influence it. And sometimes for good, sometimes for more repression. But I got away from that idea for a while. I don't know why. And now I realize more than ever that the system has become so filthy, so corrupt, it is not salvageable. There is no way to rescue either of these totally corrupted political parties. There is no way to instill in this country justice, whether it's economic justice or justice before the courts or justice in the streets. There's no way to do it. The system has to be completely revamped, changed. And that means, to me, the first thing is to get away from the stinking two-party system that actually the framers, as racist and genocidal as they were, they warned against a political party system. You know that. They said that, I don't know who it was. Was it Jefferson? Was it whoever it was that said, the only thing he feared, or the major thing he feared about this this new form of government, was the creation of political parties.
Well, you know, Mike, if you could see right now, and I think you pointed it out, and I totally agree with you, when the Supreme Court appointed George Bush president, that was the beginning of really the time when we have to make a change, and it's got up to us to change it.
Yeah, I just hope enough people will wake up to that. Mark, thanks. I got to move on because I want to get a couple more people in here. Thanks a lot for checking in. I appreciate it. Gary is in Minneapolis listening on KTNF. Hey, Gary.
How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Not too bad. By the way, can you tell Kathy to send the podcast I won 3 weeks ago? I never got it.
You didn't?
Nope.
I'll tell you what, email our webmaster, just send it to webmaster@mikemalloy.com.
Okay.
His name is George.
Okay.
And he'll get it to you. You know, sometimes there's glitches, sometimes stuff gets confusing. But if not to push you off, Gary, I'm just saying the best way to do it is just notify webmaster@mikemalloy.com and address it to George. Just say, hey, George.
I just thought I annoyed you when I was on there and you said, hell with it. I'm not sending him his damn podcast.
What happened?
I thought maybe I annoyed you when I brought up that homeless thing and you said, hell with him. I'm not sending his damn podcast.
What homeless thing?
When I asked you about bringing up the homeless problem on the air and stuff, if we could discuss that sometime.
Oh, no. Why would I? I mean, why would I do that?
Oh, I don't know. I just because I was bugging you about trying to do it. I'm trying to bug everybody. I tried to bug Hartman about it. I bugged Norman Goldman.
Well, no, it's an important issue. I got to do a break. Hold on, Gary. Then we'll come back and talk about Honeywell and the war. I used to talk about those issues a lot, but it just seems so, almost so pointless anymore. Stay there, Gary. We'll come back after the break. Listening to the Malloy program, and thank you for doing that. All right, back to Gary in Minneapolis. Honeywell and the war.
Yeah, my mother used to protest the Vietnam War, and one of the targets was Honeywell. She protested against. The
right.
Funny thing, though, at the time was my dad worked at Honeywell. So they would say, like, you know, you might not want to say anything about what you're doing working there. This is before they got divorced and stuff. So, and she asked him, what will you do if I get arrested? She goes, he goes, oh, I'll send a Honeywell lawyer down there.
And did she get arrested?
No, but she, you know, she did tell me one time they had a peaceful protest at the headquarters, and Jerry Rubin showed up,
yeah,
and he threw a chair through a window, and he took off, and then all of a sudden, hell broke loose.
Jerry Rubin was hell.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Somebody else confirmed it independently, so I guess it sounds like a true story to me.
Yeah, well, my best to your mom.
Well, she's the one that actually died a few years ago. That's how I ended up being homeless. So, but at least the L.A. Kings are doing well.
Well, somebody told me that if the Kings win, the beast will rise.
Well, I don't know. It might happen, but I think you're safe in Atlanta since you lost two hockey teams.
I don't know anything about sports, Gary. I am totally sports challenged because I gave up on professional sports a long time ago. I just couldn't take the steroids and the $80 million a year contracts and all that crap. Gary, I got to leave it there. Thanks, pal. Appreciate you checking in. Grant is driving in Kansas, listening on Sirius. Hello, Grant.
Hey, man. I love your show. Me and you go a long ways back. I've talked to you plenty of times. We go all the way back to when you were on in the afternoon on that big station out of Atlanta there where you live.
Oh, my God. That was 92.
Yeah. Well, you were on even before then, I think.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Back in the 80s, 88, 89. I started radio in 87. So, WSB was like the first place after WCNN that I worked. So, yeah, that's a long time ago. That was back in the days of the O.J. Simpson trial.
Yeah, I came aware of you after the first Gulf War when I came back in 93.
Yeah.
And me and you were joking one night. I want to get to my point here in just a second. Here recently, me and you were joking about that fat, bald guy who always was on you about wearing a Speedo. You remember?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You're talking about Bortz. Yeah, Neil, yeah. Bortz. Oh, my God.
Yeah, he had some kind of fantasy thing going on there.
He did. He definitely did.
It was weird. Hey, you know, a long time ago when I was young and idealistic, I always griped about the power brokers of the world and how they operate and everything else. And my dad is a retired Air Force colonel, 34 years,
mm-hmm.
and he was in the National Guard for 20 of that in the Air National Guard, and he was also a lawyer, and he told me that he'd made enough money where I'd never have to take care of him. And he said the thing is about the people that have a lot of money and that run this world is what you don't know is what your number is.
Uh-huh.
They can get to anybody.
Sure.
All they don't know is what your number is. He was pointing out, Mike, in my case, you've never even had $50,000 in a bank account that wasn't earmarked for something else. So all they have to do is figure out, is it $50,000, half a million, $1 million, $10 million? What is your number?
Mm-hmm.
So when people are amazed at what, like, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama have done, well, what do you think they would do?
Sure. Sure.
You know?
Absolutely.
I mean, you have to be realistic about it. And I'm not saying it's right. It's just the way that it is.
I hear you, and that brings us back, Grant, to what we've talked about a lot on this program. Both political parties are death, and if people are really serious about saving the species or saving the planet or whatever, saving our own families or children, whatever, we're going to have to make this system stop. Grant, I got to leave it there. Thanks, pal. I appreciate all the time you spent listening to this program. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Yeah, Kathy, your grandpa was a colonel, wasn't he? Colonel or lieutenant colonel? Full colonel. Army? World War I and II. Jason is in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Mike. How you doing tonight?
I'm all right. How are you?
Oh, well, not too good. I've been listening to a lot of the stuff you've been talking about the targeted assassinations and stuff.
Yeah.
I got something in my email from Common Dreams. It seems David Sirota put up a petition at whitehouse.gov.
Yeah, I saw that.
The do not kill list.
The do not kill list.
Yeah, I was wondering if you've made it over there and signed that yet. I signed it today.
You know, I have not. I saw what you're talking about, and at first I chuckled because I thought, dear God, this is what we've come to? A do not kill list? But I'm going to go over there and sign it. I am. I like everything, just about everything Sirota does. So
I think everybody needs to sign it. And, hey, I think when I started listening, you had 37 listeners. So if you and me go and the other 37, that'll be another, what, 40?
Something like that.
Yeah, there you go.
All right.
All right, man. Have a good night.
All right, Jason. Thank you, sir. Appreciate you checking in. That's a good place to stop. Right there. I'm going straight to hell, yeah. All right, have a safe weekend, all right? If you're driving, be careful. I'll see you Monday night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Have a great weekend, Kevin Kinney, wherever you are. Say goodnight, Kathy.
Goodnight, Kathy. I'm going.